The Craig Folly Show on Deadline Detroit is made possible in part by Samaritas, the state's largest private foster care and adoption agency. However, Samaritas also provides a number of other services around the state. They are one of the largest refugee resettlement agencies in Michigan. They serve homeless families, persons with disabilities, abused and trafficked women. They also provide market rate and affordable housing for seniors and HUD housing for families, and also have skilled nursing, memory care, and rehab communities in Grand Rapids, Cadillac, and Saginaw. Samaritas, we thank them for their support here at Deadline Detroit. Hey everybody, happy Thursday. Welcome to the Craig Folly Show on Deadline Detroit. Really glad that you've chosen to join me today because I think I have a fun conversation on tap. Jim Poniewozik will be my guest. He is the chief television critic at the New York Times, but he's also a Michigan native. He's going to be here in town for an author event next week. He's also written a really cool book called Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. Really fascinating look at how television has changed since the Reagan era and how Donald Trump has taken advantage of these changes in the technology and the messaging and the types of shows that are out there to keep himself in the limelight for all these decades. Pretty fascinating stuff. So stay tuned for that coming up on The Craig Folly Show. The Craig Folly Show on Deadline Detroit is made possible in part by Tech Town Detroit, Detroit's entrepreneurship hub. TechTown Detroit is a business incubator and accelerator, helping tech startups and local businesses launch and grow. TechTown supports businesses with co-working, office, meeting, and event space. They also connect entrepreneurs to resources and learning and networking events in Detroit. TechTown Detroit, Detroit's entrepreneurship hub. Hey, Craig here. Thanks very much for tuning in today. I really do appreciate it. Hey, coming up on Monday is a really cool event. It's the 95th Book and Author Society Luncheon. This has been going on for a long time. It's at Burton Manor in Livonia, which is on Schoolcraft right there. Four featured authors there are going to be sharing stories about writing and, of course, their latest work. We've got Susan Isaacs, who's going to be there, Deborah Blum, Bridget Davis, and, of course, my guest, Jim Poniewozik. Jim is the chief television critic at the New York Times. He's also the author of Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. But he's also a Michigan native. He grew up in Monroe and attended the University of Michigan, so he's coming home to this book festival happening on Monday. And we're excited to have him join us right now. Jim, welcome to the Craig Folly Show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
This book, it's really fascinating stuff. When you start talking about how much television has changed since the age of Ronald Reagan to now, as somebody who grew up in the 70s and 80s, you know, I look at what I've got available to me now compared to what I had when I was a kid, and I'm floored. But it's not just the choices, Jim. It also seems to be the way that everything is so customized and tailored to individuals that is really sort of changing this medium in ways that, as you point out, aren't always healthy. That this is inhibiting our ability to talk rationally anymore. And I don't want to necessarily blame television, because television gets blamed for everything in our society. It has for a long time. But it does seem to be having an impact on our ability to actually communicate with one another on a rational basis. Is there any evidence out there to suggest that this might be right?
I think that our political discourse is evidence of it. I think that a lot of our political media is evidence of it. I mean, look, I like you say, I don't blame television for this either. You know, I'm a professional TV critic. I would not become a TV critic if I hated it, because, you know, I'm not a masochist. I think it's a fantastic medium that has made a tremendous, you know, creative and social things possible. But it is a tool. And like any tool, it can be used in different ways, and it is important to know what this machine's effects are. And one of the effects of the fragmentation of media when it comes to the sort of public discourse that is increasingly, you know, and has been for decades, that has been carried out through this medium, is that you end up with people, number one, only talking to those people who very much agree with them. And then that leads to the expectation that, you know, I should only hear messages that I should agree with, and everything else is the enemy or should be rejected or not listened to. And you end up with people talking past one another. I think that there, you know, are a lot of benefits to modern media, but this is a definite effect of it that you know that it's contributed to. And, you know, I should also say, when you talk about the polarization of politics, you know, it's sort of a takes two to tango kind of thing. It's not like television creates polarization on its own, but you know, niche targeted television and media is simply a very useful tool for politicians or other figures that want to polarize audiences. You know, so the people who use this medium are, you know, still ultimately responsible. But this is certainly an effect that that tool can have.
Well, and we'll talk about one of the people that has benefited greatly from this in just a moment. I want to remind folks, my guest right now is Jim Poniewozik. He's the chief television critic at The New York Times, and he also has a book out called Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television, and the Fracturing of America. He is going to be speaking in Livonia on Monday at the 95th edition of the Biannual Book and Author Society Luncheon. About 1,000 guests expected out in Burton Manor in Livonia for that. And if you are somebody who loves literature and reading, this is an event for you. By the way, Jim is a Monroe, Michigan native.
That's right.
University of Michigan graduate as well. And by the way, my friend Don Gagne from NPR, also Monroe native.
That's so right.
Lots of famous people down there.
Apparently, so Paul Smith of WJR, who I just recently spoke to, also a Monroe native. So
oh, very good.
Something in the water. I don't know. That Lake Erie water.
Well, Custer is from there too, so
ah,
you know, you gotta figure that. But anyway, let's get back to this. I hinted at President Trump a minute ago. This is a guy that has figured out how to utilize television to his advantage from the first days that he really arrived on the public scene. He was really good at figuring out how to get on the CNNs of the world, you know, the news channels, to get coverage of himself just as who he was. And it has morphed, I mean, to the point where he's been so engaged in television over the course of the last few decades that he was just part of our collective consciousness. Why was Donald Trump able to figure this out in a way that others haven't?
I think, you know, he had an instinct for it. He had an interest in show business and performance from early on. You know, I don't think that this was sort of, you know, a Machiavellian scheme. You know, in the sense that, you know, if I see the power of this medium, and if I simply execute this clever ruse over the next 50 years, I'll be in a position to be elected president. I think that by instinct, he was drawn to celebrity. He was drawn to attention. He understood, you know, that in a mediated celebrity culture, attention was an important commodity, and that, you know, as a real estate developer in New York, it was more valuable to be perceived as the flashiest, most famous personification of wealth in the media than it was necessarily to be the actual most successful real estate developer, because the appearance is something that you can translate into a brand. It's something that you can license and build. And that can be applied in many, many other arenas as well.
Well, I mean, do I blame Robin Leach for this? I mean, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, it certainly seems as if that type of programming and where we were in the 1980s, in the Reagan years, where that sort of celebrity and that sort of success really seemed to be something that people gravitated to. It was almost the reality TV of the time.
Yeah.
He took advantage of it really, really well.
And had great timing. You know, I think that, you know, starting his public career basically around the turn of the 80s, at the beginning of the Reagan years, he was coming along at a time when the popular culture after the 60s, after the more sort of egalitarian 70s, was starting to embrace, you know, these figures of flashy, love to hate them, flamboyant rich people, whether it was, you know, the characters on Dynasty or J.R. Ewing on Dallas. You know, there was space in the culture increasingly for somebody who wanted to kind of play the brash, peacocky, braggadocious character that Donald Trump very instinctively was drawn toward playing. And he cultivated an audience for that. You know, he did that even before television in the gossip columns of the New York papers, built that into sort of local media celebrity and transformed that into a national presence. And this dovetailed with a culture, as you say, where increasingly wealth was becoming a kind of celebrity and performance in itself. A part of Robin Leach's philosophy in starting the Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous is that when people, you know, watched profiles of celebrities, they didn't necessarily want to know about their work or their art or whatnot. They wanted to know about their things and tour their mansions and, you know, see their fabulous lifestyles. And, you know, Donald Trump, you know, in the 80s, essentially was a one-man Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Well, and the thing is, he would make appearances on any show that would invite him. He'd show up in movies. He'd show up in television shows, sitcoms, things like that, as himself, even if he was somewhat being slightly mocked in some of these instances. And most of the time, it was pretty tongue-in-cheek type of stuff. He recognized that keeping himself out there, regardless of the context, was more important perhaps than what the actual context was.
Yeah, he did, you know, he was big into talk shows. He did Letterman, and obviously, you know, Letterman mocks and makes fun of everyone. He did sitcom cameos, you know, that would often be sort of tongue-in-cheek and ridiculous and so forth. But nonetheless, and, you know, this is a pattern that repeats, you know, in Trump's later career, there's this sense of this joke that also has a serious purpose, which is to say, even if he's doing these ridiculous cameos and talk show appearances and so on, they're all also reinforcing, simply through the fact of his being there and the subject of him and kind of the way he's being used as set dressing, they reinforce the idea of, you know, Donald Trump, even if he's kind of a figure of fun, is this fabulous rich guy who lives the lifestyle that you would if you won the lottery. And as you go into, you know, from the 1980s into the 90s, when he runs into financial trouble and some of his companies hit bankruptcies and he has creditors to pay back, literally playing himself as a character becomes his main job. You know, it becomes his chief responsibility to maintain this sort of media presence, to maintain this image and visibility, because that boosts the brand, that makes the Trump brand valuable to the creditors that need it to retain value. So essentially, the character of Donald Trump has to bail out the actual Donald Trump.
Well, and at what point, though, does that caricature become the reality of who the person is? I mean, the public persona may be different than the private person, but as we have seen, it certainly seems as if the two have become one.
Yeah, and I think you reach a point where if there is a private persona that is separate from the public persona, it sort of doesn't matter because it's the public persona who is, you know, calling the shots, who's determining, you know, how this public figure acts and what he does. And what that persona does is what the media is rewarding it for, right? When you rely on media attention for your business, for your celebrity, for your, you know, raison d'etre, then you are going to play the version of yourself that you are rewarded for with attention. If you are rewarded for being provocative and obnoxious and insulting, then you're going to be more provocative and obnoxious and insulting. If you're rewarded for being, you know, flashy or cocky, et cetera, you're going to give the camera more of that. And ultimately, you know, maybe there is a separate version of you that is distinct from that. Maybe there's not, but the fake you, as it were, the you that's on camera really matters more than any separate real you. You know, that performance of you is the one who's bringing home the bacon, and it's that performance of Donald Trump, this Donald Trump that made himself into a pop culture shorthand for business and wealth, that makes him a natural to be cast on The Apprentice by Mark Burnett. You know, because reality TV is all about presenting a broad, easily apprehendable symbol of the thing rather than necessarily the thing itself.
Yeah. I should remind folks, my guest right now is Jim Poniewozik, the author of Audience of One. He, of course, is the New York Times chief television critic. And I don't want to spend all the time talking about the president because in my regular time slot for the show, I do a lot of that kind of stuff because I cover politics, obviously. You said something early on in this conversation that I thought was pretty important. You said one thing that the proliferation of channels and options has led to are better shows. Yep. You know, and I was watching MeTV the other night, you know this channel, I'm sure, and I saw episodes of Barnaby Jones and Cannon back to back, a couple of old 70s shows I remember when I was a kid. And I was watching just how bad the production was, how bad some of the acting was. The plots were really, really weak. And you compare it to something like, I don't know, Game of Thrones or Walking Dead or anything else that's popular these days. We are light years beyond where we were when it comes to the willingness to take chances on content. And willingness to be a lot more controversial in it. That seems to be a relatively recent thing, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, some of that is just a function of business and, you know, money. I mean, people are just pouring a lot more dollars into Game of Thrones than they ever were into Mayberry RFD or whatever, right? But it is also a function of the medium and the structure of the business, and therefore the audience. Back in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, when TV was basically a three-network medium, you had everything that went on air, anything that the three networks programmed, had to reach an audience of tens of millions to survive. You couldn't just be a niche hit with a few hundred thousand viewers and succeed. And what that meant was that things had to be broadly palatable. They had to not give people a reason to change the channel. You had to aim for what was called in the TV business back at the time, the least objectionable program. And that basically means, you know, something that doesn't give people a reason not to like it, you know, something not too controversial, something not too provocative, something not in any way offensive. And again, you know, one effect of this was that, you know, you had more family programming, you had more things that tens of millions of us all watched and enjoyed together at the same time, right? The big tent, the Ed Sullivan era. But it also made for a lot of blandness and homogeneousness and aversion to risk taking. And so one thing that you have, that you can have, once you have, you know, hundreds of cable channels, once you have more outlets that rely, like, say, HBO, on people choosing to subscribe rather than just flipping on a free channel in their living room, is that you're rewarded for taking risks because you have to cut through the noise. You have to do things that are more original and give people a reason to seek you out rather than avoiding reasons to turn you off. And that has, you know, created a lot of the greatest art, if I may say so, of, you know, the 21st century.
And I won't ask you to make any specific recommendations here on that one, but just to follow up on this for a second, you're talking about trying not to offend people. Do you ever expect that we'll see a situation like we did when, say, Will and Grace first came on the air, or when Murphy Brown tackled controversial subjects, where it would be the subject of media discussion for days on end?
It can still happen. You know, I think we have seen that happen in the past couple of years even, but it needs to happen under more and more special circumstances. You know what I mean? Like, it's not simply going to, you know, be the talk of the town to, you know, put a show on the air about an outspoken newswoman or the first gay character on primetime television, because we've gone through a lot of those firsts. But you see it happen with things like, say, the revival of Roseanne, where there's sort of an extrinsic reason for people to be curious about it, right? Like a controversial star who maybe has been controversial even for reasons outside the context of the show. Or something like, you know, Game of Thrones, which has been kind of one of the last big water cooler shows on the air, that builds and builds and becomes a phenomenon and eventually draws, it becomes the kind of phenomenon that a lot of people are following at once. But that's becoming much, much more the exception than the rule, these kind of, you know, broad, widely shared experiences.
Well, Jim, one last question for you on this. Yeah. As we mentioned, you mentioned, of course, all the different ways, subscription services, we're seeing streaming services, the cable providers, the satellite providers, all struggling with new deals with the content providers, and many of them just going their own separate way. Do you get a sense that viewers and consumers are going to be willing to subscribe to six, eight different services just to get the stuff that they want?
This is one of the things that people like civilians, non-TV critics, bring up most often with me. You know, when I tell them what I do, and I think everybody's still figuring that out. You know, I mean, the fact is people have gotten used to, even if they don't like it, paying $100, $200 for their monthly cable bill. You know, we may be returning to a form where people, you know, pay an internet bill and then are paying the equivalent of that much for various streaming services. But, you know, I've also seen people increasingly, you know, adopt sort of workarounds where they'll have, you know, one or two shows they really want to watch on Hulu. So they'll get Hulu for a month or two and then watch those things and drop it and kind of move serially onto another thing. Honestly, though, it's, I think TV critics and TV viewers, this is a fascinating thing to me about TV right now. I don't think any of us entirely knows how streaming is going to change TV, because it's kind of the next thing after cable that is, you know, it's breaking up the idea of, you know, having TV schedules at all. It's making TV a much more kind of distributed and, you know, something like Netflix, it's weird. It's sort of mass and extremely niche at the same time, right? Because on the one hand, Netflix is kind of something that's returning to the old big tent modeling of broadcasting, where there's something on Netflix for everybody. On the other hand, because of the algorithms, you know, you and I, if we both have Netflix, we see entirely different versions of it. You know, I'll get different shows suggested to me, even different pictures on the thumbnail illustrations for that show. So, you know, I think this is kind of a decision that consumers are just going to kind of make one channel, you know, one streaming service at a time until they hit their budget limits, and they'll kind of have to figure that out.
All right. Well, we are looking forward to you being here in Livonia on Monday. Welcome home, by the way. It's going to be nice to have you back.
Thank you.
In the Mitten State, I should remind folks again, my guest has been James Poniewozik. He's the chief television critic at the New York Times. He is also the author of Audience of One, Donald Trump, Television and the Fracturing of America. He's one of the keynote speakers at the 95th Book and Author Society Luncheon. Again, this is on Monday, starting at 11 a.m. at Burton Manor in Livonia. That's on Schoolcraft there. So if you know anything about Livonia, it's not hard to find. It's right there. You can see it on the side of the freeway. Everybody knows where it is. But thank you so much for your time. I certainly do appreciate it, and we're looking forward to this.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a great talk.
Jim Poniewozik is the chief television critic at the New York Times. Again, his latest book, Audience of One. Take a look. He's going to be at Burton Manor on Monday in Livonia. It should be a lot of fun for those of you that love books and authors. These are always great events, and I like to make sure that people know that they're happening out there, because despite what you might think, there are still a ton of readers out there, and that's a great thing. Hey, thanks for listening today. I do appreciate it. Don't forget, you can send me a message, thecraigfolleyshow@gmail.com. Find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, LinkedIn, all that good stuff. And a reminder, tomorrow, the week that was. That's always a fun discussion about the week that happened. And boy, did a lot of stuff happen this week. Things are getting weirder by the day. We'll have some fun with that tomorrow. Looking forward to it. Something to look forward to next week. I do believe I'm going to get a chance to talk with my friend Megan Owens of Transit Riders United early next week. They've got an event coming up, taking a look at transit options and what's going on now that there's a leadership change in Oakland County. Might we get closer to a true regional transit system? We'll find out a little bit more about that next week, along with some other cool subjects that I've already got lined up. So stick around. Check it out every day. I love doing the show, and I appreciate the fact that you are here with me. Have a great day, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow for the week that was. This has been The Craig Folley Show on Deadline Detroit. The Craig Folley Show on Deadline Detroit is made possible in part by Mad Dog Professional Services. Mad Dog Professional Services focuses on putting their clients on the leading edge of technology, faster than thought possible, to capture new revenue streams. That's Mad Dog Professional Services.